If you're like me, you probably have a closet full of local band merch. And whether you know it or not, a lot of that band merch was probably made by Divine Shirt Company right here in Winnipeg. Divine Shirt Company has made all of the Great Witch Police merch, from our hoodies to our toques to our t-shirts. And if you're looking to get anything done, like screen printing, embroidery, graphic design, digital printing, go to see Divine Shirt Company at divineshirtcompany.ca and tell them Witch Police Radio sent you.
One of our colleagues, Sam Thompson, who, if you saw him, you'd sort of right away assume he was a hippie.
Witch Police Radio. Witch Police Radio. Oh, no, no, no.
Witch Police Radio.
You are listening to Witch Police Radio. This is Greg Soden, guest hosting for normal host Sam Thompson. This conversation on this episode is with John Paul Peters. John Paul Peters is a multi-award-winning producer, songwriter, arranger, audio engineer, mixer, musician, and is co-owner at Private Ear Recording in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada. He has produced, engineered, and mixed projects in a wide variety of genres for over two decades. JP is a multi-instrumentalist skilled at violin, guitar, bass, keys, percussion, and more. He has numerous instrumental, vocal, and writing credits on albums and singles he has produced, and he has played in several touring bands before moving into full-time production. The Undecided and Officer Down were signed to Tooth & Nail Records and Goodfellow Records. If you've never heard The Undecided, they sound like this. If you've never heard Officer Down, they sound like this. Additionally, JP has been an instructor of audio production at Providence College and Canadian Mennonite University, in addition to providing consulting services to a variety of clients. I got to know JP a bit because of his work with Propagandy, and it was a delight to catch up with him on a very broad range of work he has done at Private Ear Recording. Please enjoy this conversation with John Paul Peters. John Paul Peters, welcome to Witch Police Radio.
Heck yes. Well, glad to be here.
I am delighted that you're here. JP, this is kind of an interesting thing for me because I do not live in Winnipeg. I live in Buffalo, New York, and I don't host Witch Police Radio. I host Unscripted Moments, a podcast about Propagandy, which is where you and I first connected. But I am delighted to come on here and talk to you about your life in music. And like the way that you are super immersed in what's going on in Winnipeg. And we'll chat about a little bit about your own musical performance background, a little bit about your production background and some of the work that you're doing these days. So I'm super grateful to you for your time, to do this with me today. I'm wondering if we can just start by having you tell me a little bit about your memories of growing up and finding music in general. Tell me about how this all started for you.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think for me, I would say there was a certain amount of sheltering, like parental sheltering, very conservative, family. I don't begrudge that, but I definitely was not exposed young to like a lot of the classics, like classic rock, stuff like that. Just was not something that was in our house. And so I kind of had to get that little bits and pieces. And as I started to kind of, it really pulled me in when I would hear like early Metallica. Mm. Or I started with some Christian rock because, well, at least if I got caught with that, I could be like, well, it's Christian rock or whatever. But as you know, it was like little snippets of different things. And it was almost like an outlet, like a rebellious outlet for me, where I was like learning music, but it was also me finding something other, I guess. Mm. And yeah, like, and then I, you know, skateboarding, like that, you know, hanging out with certain people, also getting into some more nefarious, like just stupid, you know, activities as a kid. Like I wanted to drink and I wanted to smoke. Because what are these things? And we're not allowed to do any of this stuff. And I wanted to listen to heavy metal and I wanted to hear everything. And it's just, I felt like I was constricted and I needed to bloom. So for me, the musical discovery was kind of late, maybe compared to like so many people I know, it's like, oh yeah, my, you know, grew up listening to Tom Petty or like whatever. I didn't. So I've had to like refine so much of the artists that would have created like a really great base to go off even as a producer. Mm. So, and I still find it happens all the time where I'm just like, not, I'm like, I don't know this class. Like I know a lot of the songs cause I've heard them, but I don't always know the artist.
Yeah.
Like if you say Deep Purple, I can't list 5 songs.
Yeah. Well, and it's really interesting too, cause my parents had a huge record collection in their basement, but I never heard it. So I one time forced my dad to show me how to play records on it. And then I was like listening to Kansas and I was listening to Boston and I was listening to Carole King and I was listening to Led Zeppelin, whatever I could pull out of that shelf of records, I was playing it, but I was having to do it myself. No one was showing it to me. So I was kind of on this weird thing where I had like a very non-musical house as well, but it was kind of me figuring it out along the way.
And were they just on a musical break when they had kids or?
Yeah. I guess, but like, it's one of those things to where like you see all these records in the background of my house too. I'm trying to play music around the house as much as I can and just be aware that like people get sucked into this like void of adulthood. You know what I mean? Where those kinds of things just kind of go away when you grow up, but I'm trying to avoid that. So hopefully it'll be a little different for my kiddo.
I think you're probably doing a better job than me. Fortunately, my kids are like, you know, with the Spotify's and stuff like that, they're really finding like a huge plethora of music and they're coming around to stuff that I used to like on their own, which is really interesting. But because I work with music all day, sometimes I just need that downtime in the evening. So I'm not just like instantly turning on something else. And I actually have to like, that's like my weekend thing or whatever. Well, so that's the downside.
Yeah. You know, as someone who like, I make podcasts nonstop, so I'm not in a producer role or a engineer role like you are. But making podcasts, I found that I listen to fewer podcasts than ever. So I was wondering, like, as a music engineer, are you listening to less music than ever when you're outside of work? Has it become like a work-only thing for you?
I would say it's not a work-only thing, but I'll admit to listening to more podcasts than music.
Awesome. Very
like,
cool.
In my spare time, like if I'm out on a bike ride or whatever, and I do, you know, a couple rides a week or whatever, I've got my earbuds in and I'm listening to, you know, like political or UAPs or whatever stuff, you know, geographical. I like a lot of things. So I tend to do, it's probably about a 70-30 split.
Nice.
But then I find new music and I'm like, why am I not listening to new music all the time?
Yeah.
Because there's so much great shit out there.
Oh, totally. Okay, so I want to chat about your bands a little bit. Whenever you agreed to do this, I went back and was listening to Officer Down, Undecided, and I was like, wow, there's a really wide variety of sounds here that JP managed to explore in your own music. And so what are some of your big standouts about like getting involved in music and like starting some of these bands that, you know, we can look back on like with like 20 years of hindsight now?
Well, I think just the joy of like when I started, I was playing covers. So I think I was in grade 9. So I was playing in a like rock band that played covers. We played at a couple graduations. We played like, you know, lots of like classic Canadian stuff and like some Top of the Pops kind of rock stuff. And that didn't last very long because I was just feeling like I was just a kind of a piece in a cog in the thing, but it was a good experience to play live. And then I met this guy who ended up being, he's been like my best friend for my whole life, Steve Duick. And he was like, I want to get a drum set. So he didn't play instruments, but he was like, I love music and I just want to get a drum set and I want to play punk rock. And I was like, okay, I guess like I have a drum. I had this old drum set. So I sold it to him and it, you know, snares on a, like a chair, We didn't have a snare stand. Anyway, so he takes that home, and then he's like, "You should come over. We're going to jam." And I was like, "Well, this guy doesn't even know how to play."
Yeah.
So, it was a little begrudgingly, and he was 2 years older, and I'm like, "I don't really know you that well," but he kept calling me up, and I started going over to his place to jam. And after like a couple of days, we were just like playing the most random stuff. And it was so fun. Like, it was definitely terrible. It was absolutely like the worst thing. And we would switch. I would play drums, he'd play guitar. He didn't play guitar. Just crank up the distortion and make sounds. And we would record tapes. We'd record lots of, and we had all these names for our different bands. I'm not even going to, you know, it's all the stuff that, okay, Fish Bucket being one of them. Like, where does this come from? Who knows? But you're just having fun in the basement. And you're like, this is really like sludgy. So like, whatever. So we just did that. And I kind of realized that I was having way more fun just making stuff with no goal than when I was trying to like learn those songs. And it's like, it's great to do covers and improve your skills and all that. But yeah, like just really discovering the joy of just creating stuff. And then that between the two of us, it started to hone into actual songs. And then we started to get other guys involved and then kind of made some bands. And then that eventually transitioned into like playing shows. I think I was probably 16 when we played Alternative Cabaret in Winnipeg, like, which was a bar. And when I got snuck in the back kind of thing, and first show, Alternative Cabaret with The Undecided. And it was not The Undecided of the kind of pseudo-religious stage of, you know, Tooth and Nail era. It was like hardcore. It was like screaming and like political rants and just like swearing our heads off. And it was so, so awesome.
That is amazing.
But yeah, I should say I was exposed to music like earlier. So I wasn't in a non-musical home, but it was like there was either gospel or classical kind of thing.
Yeah.
So my mom had me in violin. She was like, you either play violin or piano. And I'm like, okay, violin. So I got into that and pushed really far into that. So by the time I was 12, but then I think I was like past my grade 10 and was like going to provincial competitions and things like that. And there was so much pressure, and I hated the pressure aspect of it. And I fell really, I don't know if you know of the Suzuki violin program.
Oh, sure. I did that when I was in elementary school.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah.
So amazing ear training, right? And that I would credit with like building so much of my capabilities now. But at the same time, my crutch was that I couldn't read like music. And I would require, like, I just never got good at it because it's way easier just to listen for me. And, and so when I got placed in these more kind of advanced ensembles and things like that, it'd be like, hey, next week we're performing three songs in this hall in a quartet, and you have to learn all these concertos. And you're relied on because you're in a group. And it was like decimating. And I did this huge performance where I just faked my way through it and made up my own notes for half of it.
Yeah.
And it was like so soul crushing. I just said, that's the end. I'm not doing violin anymore. I want to play guitar. I want to do my own thing. And so my mom said, okay, you can do whatever you want. So I saved up money and bought a guitar and played annoying music in the basement.
You still play violin though, right? I was looking at some of your Discogs credits, and I saw that you're considered to, like, have you ever played like violin on any records that you've produced in private ear or anything like that?
Oh, yeah,
figured you would have. Yeah, I figured that skill was still going on to this day. Do you like doing that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I love it. I absolutely love it. I'm actually owning it now. Because I stopped when I was 12, something got into my head like, you've forgotten that. You don't do that anymore. I think it's like a language. When you don't exercise it for 10 years, you're just like, well, I don't speak French anymore, really. But then you get into the position of like either enjoying it again. Like I started to just play for fun. And then I'm like, oh, I haven't lost this. Like I've lost it a little bit, but man, does it come back. And so yeah, I mean, I probably played on 3 or 4 records this year already. Like,
man,
and songs.
Awesome.
I love it. Whether it's like playing weird. I used to do a lot of like harmonic kind of Polish and Roma style kind of folk dances and like more, because my violin teacher was like very, you know, pot smoking. I didn't know that at the time, but like fascinated with more, I guess, out of the main path of classical music styles, like more Eastern and stuff. So I learned like artificial harmonics and like all sorts of scratching techniques and stuff like that. And so that's, I think that's my, I love adding layers and ambiences and soundscapes and, you know, obviously the standard orchestral stuff I can do too. But anyway, I love it and I'm owning it. I play the damn instrument.
Yeah. Hell yeah. What about Officer Down? What is your like biggest memory of that? Because I was listening to that record yesterday, Subversive Paradigm. And I was like, because I'm mostly familiar with your performance through The Undecided. So Officer Down was a pretty big shock for me.
Yeah, that band, I think that band, when we look back at it, we all think that one had the most potential because of kind of what it is. Like the different members in the band kind of brought a really more like a progressive thing that wasn't really being done yet. We were like, as far as going from these like clean dynamic things to these big builds and stuff like that. So it was very easy for us to like sell out the West End here in Winnipeg or whatever. Like we didn't, when we played, it was always, there was a lot of hype and we were just all into it, but we had no aspirations as far as like, oh, we got to get on a label or do all this. And we did end up signing to like a Hamilton label called Goodfellow through a friend.
Yeah, I saw that.
Goodfellow Records. And they're actually, they're coming alive this year and releasing a new project from the original, the guy that started the label. So I guess, yeah, Officer Down was always very easy. But we would always like, we would dress up at concerts. We'd like cover ourselves in like sackcloth and ashes, or like cover ourselves in mud, or build huge sets, or, you know, we made videos and wired black and white TVs together and played like apocalyptic, you know, videos in the background. Like we always had something going on, and it was just, the members were all so creative. The Undecided was more like, we're trying to do punk rock, right?
Yeah.
And that was good. But Officer Down, we never really captured that band. That's the sad part to me, is like the sonically it never got what it deserved. And I mean, our recording, even that album was recorded like start to finish in 4 days.
Yeah.
And you know, it's just, you can hear it, you can hear, and the guitar tones are just abysmal. Like that's not what we sounded like, but it's what came across in the recording process. And actually that album is one of the big reasons that created an itch that I have to scratch, because having a record that you just regret the sound of, it's like, how do we do this? Like, I need control. So that actually, that's the first paradigm album is like one of the reasons why I'm doing this.
Okay.
Now,
well,
it was like, got to figure this shit out.
That's a perfect segue too, because I was curious about your entryway into production after being in bands. So you want to just keep going with that little train of thought there?
Sure. Yeah. Like, you know, it started to occur to me, what if I would record, you know, I think a lot of people get to this point. It's like they have a negative experience in the studio or stuff. It's just like, why don't I take control of my destiny? Like, what if I recorded, you know, myself or learned? And I remember one, you know, being a guitar player, I would see in that Subversive Paradigm session, it's like there's several mics on the guitar cab and there's all these room mics being set up and, you know, but what I'm hearing back in the speakers, I just don't feel like it's what's coming off the amp. And I always had people comment on, like, I had a very basic tone. It was a Gibson Les Paul Gold Top Deluxe. I think it's up in the corner of the room.
Oh,
I've had
fun.
It since I was 16.
Holy cow. Nice.
Back there. That is the OG guitar I got when I was 16. Paid for working at a gas station.
Phenomenal.
Yeah. Got a really sweet deal on it. Anyway, it was through an OG triple rec with all the knobs on half through a V30s cab. And it was like, are you familiar with Josh Schrader? We don't really know each other that well, but we went to the same school in Steinbeck. So Steinbeck's a little town outside Winnipeg, little Christian town. So Josh Schrader is one of the biggest metal producers in the States right now. He's doing like Lorna Shore, like all these bands. And so he was 3 years younger than me, 3 or 4 years younger. But we just were chatting a couple weeks ago on text, and I really respect his work. He's absolutely top notch. And he was talking about how he first heard like my guitar tone live. And he was like, I want to do that. And I'm like, wow, that's so flattering, you know, because what was I doing? I just had my Les Paul plugged into an amp. But something about that and the sound was one of the things that made him want to get into like heavier music.
Cool.
And now he's like, you know, top of the crop.
And you were a turning point for him.
Yeah. And even that just makes me so happy, you know, like but thinking of that guitar tone, that is not represented like on our Subversive Paradigm album. And I'm like, what is with all this, these moving the mic? Where's the Holy Grail? There must be this magic. I didn't know that it's actually not as hard as I thought, but it seemed like this mountain that I needed to climb.
Yeah. Well, okay. So to the best of your ability, can you tell me the chronology of Privateer Studios in Winnipeg?
Okay. So Privateer Recording existed from like maybe 1996 or so with different owners in a different location. We recorded with The Undecided there, not with Officer Down. We did two records with The Undecided, one with Neil King, who also produced or engineered the Dookie record for Green Day. Mm-hmm. So,
holy cow.
Yeah, so he came up to do our second Tooth and Nail record, and then we mixed it in Vancouver. And that was all very illuminating for me. Well, yeah, like, I mean, he didn't produce it, but again, the tones on it, like, it's an epic record to be part of, right? And to see him work, that was big for me. Like, I wasn't even thinking of being getting into production or engineering, but I was so captivated by just the confidence. Like, he didn't screw up the punch-ins on tape. It just all flowed. He had such a great demeanor, and I wanted to perform. Like, I wanted to play. And I'm like, this person I respect so much. And then mixing the record in Vancouver, I wasn't sitting there hawkeyeing like what he was doing. Our deal was he had to mix 4 songs a day, which is insane. Yeah. And he was like, this isn't fair. They're not paying me enough. You know? So I would leave the studio for an hour and give him time to set up. And then I would come back and he'd say, what do you think of this? What do you think of that? And so I was the designated person to be there and just kind of help him keep his head on when he was stressing about all the things that you have to do, mixing through an SSL, mixing on tape, and doing 4 songs a day and committing them.
Wow.
So yeah, that's the More to See album that he did. And, you know, I listen back to it and I just think about that. I'm like, 4 songs a day. You know, it's intense.
Yeah, what is a better rate for mixing, like as far as speed of songs goes?
Well, he would have preferred to do 1 or 2 a day.
Sure.
Yeah, but the budget wasn't there. So I think we had 3 days of rented time at Hipposonic Studio in Vancouver at the time.
Nice.
I think they've been gone for a while, but I'm sure those mixing boards move around from studio to studio. So I'm sure that one went to the next iteration, and then Mushroom imploded shortly thereafter, and who knows. But yeah, so chronology of Privateer, Undecided recorded there. And then it was 2006. They lost their lease in that space. And I was freelance. So I had already recorded like the first Comeback Kid record, Bigger Four. And then I was doing some pop stuff and some rock stuff. Like I was doing just whatever I could, working out of my basement and then renting studios at the time. And then I had my first kid 2005. And still worked out of the basement for a while, but then I started to really feel like I needed a space away from the home. And so that's when I talked to, well, there was some other stuff. There was a cabin studio up near Grand Beach, Manitoba, where a friend of mine built it, and we would take projects up there and stay for night. And it was really cool, but it was tiny. It was like 600 square feet, and made a lot of records there. And it was, but after a while, it was like the drive, which was an hour, was starting to get prohibitive. And it's like, if I'm up there for 3 days, I'm not seeing my child for 3 days.
Right.
And just, you know, you got to maintain the delicate balance. I had a lot to learn. So we needed a place in the city. And so I talked to one of the previous owners of Privateer and asked if they were interested in, his name's Neil. And I was asking whether he would like to start a new space. Because they had to pull the plug in a flash. Like they were given an extension on their lease, and then the landlord just like pulled it. And within 3 weeks they had to pull out, and they were in the middle of a record. So all the gear just literally went into a shed in the country with no humidity control.
Wow.
So the console, the piano was all just like, I can't even believe it. Like I would have got storage.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, don't put it out in some barn anyway. There's a lot of weird things there, but then yeah. So we talked about building this space, and I would basically have a production suite, and then the bigger studio would be managed by the other engineer, and you know, it would be more of a rental scenario, right? Like the old privateer. But that was right around the time that home studios were really taking off. So there was a lot less rentals. So that whole plan kind of changed around a bit, but yeah. So 2008 is when we built, when we got started, and we were mixing in here before it was finished and before it was drywalled. And so, yeah, it's been like 14 years here already, actually almost 15, which is crazy.
That is fabulous. You know, I'm wondering, about some of the work that you've done there, right? So a lot of the stuff that I know from you, Agassi, Mobina Galore, Propagandi, Cancer Bats. I was listening to The Spark That Moves by Cancer Bats yesterday, yeah. And I was like, oh, yeah. Comeback Kid, you did Wake the Dead, Turn It Around. Like, I know those
things. Wake the Dead.
Did you work on Wake the Dead?
I'm tight-lipped on that, but I didn't work on the original one.
Oh, okay. So I'm wrong on that. That's totally fine. But there's all this other stuff now that
Heavy Steps.
Heavy Steps. Yes, you did Heavy Steps, which is absolutely fantastic. And you know what's so funny? Whenever I see live videos of Comeback Kid at like Furnace Fest or something doing stuff from Heavy Steps, I'm like, JP made that record. Like, because I've got this like little connection to you from the last couple of years. And so whenever I see people going nuts at like festivals and stuff for like Propagandi or Comeback Kid, I'm like, JP recorded that record. That's pretty sweet. You know, it just, it's a neat thing.
That is very kind. I would say my production with them is a great part of it was managing the amount of material that we were trying to get done. So we did basically two records worth of material in 2000 and I guess it was 2022. Like we did Heavy Steps. We did 18 songs.
Wow.
And then the next batch got released with like Trouble in the Winner's Circle and others. So the plan was, Andrew's plan was get as much stuff done so we can have like a 2-year plan or 3-year plan for releasing material, which is brilliant. Because they tour so much, right? So, you know, if they had to like interrupt their lives to do, you know, the studio every 2 years.
Right.
And they were on a really like positive writing spree, I guess. So
yeah,
but so when you say that when move. You like, I definitely wasn't writing with them. I mean, the Comeback Kid's vision is those guys. Like,
yeah, it's very cool. Well, so there's other stuff. You've got this amazing playlist on your website. Some of my favorite stuff: Mise en Scène, Matt Foster, Landreth Brothers. Love that. JP Ho. Matt Epp, Royal Canoe. There's so much stuff on here on this playlist. And I was just kind of amazed at the variety of stuff that you get to hear. Are these Winnipeg folks that you are mostly working with besides some of those big names that I listed earlier?
Yeah, I would say for the most part. I mean, I just finished, you know, a month with Chastity. They're from Toronto. Great, fantastic band. I should say Hamilton. So I do, I mean, I've been to England. I produced a punk rock record back in 2005 in London, like a small band that had heard the original Comeback Kid and was like, you know, and they were called Bay Six. And I think they've been done for over 10 years now, but great guys. It was a great experience. Like I would say 90% is local. Winnipeg is like a garden city. There's just like, there's so much stuff getting started here in different genres. And you know, before you actually said like that I was immersed in the Winnipeg music scene, what's crazy is I actually don't even feel like I'm wetting my feet in Winnipeg's music scene. Like there's other engineers, there's so many different scenes that are like going on that I don't even know. I seriously don't even know half of it. It's crazy. Yeah. And nobody else does either. Because every one of my clients is like, oh, you know, these guys and that and those guys. And I'm like, I don't. And then I mentioned a bunch of people and they've never heard of them.
Yeah.
It's bizarre.
Yeah. I mean, Buffalo's kind of like that as well. I kind of feel like Buffalo and Winnipeg have a lot in common, where they're kind of smaller cities. They're a little isolated and they're kind of overlooked. But like we have amazing stuff going on here, too. Like we have a studio called GCR, which is owned by Robbie Tekak from the Goo Goo Dolls. And there's an amazing local producer here named Jay Zabriskie, who does tons of great stuff. And so
I'm familiar with his name.
Jay Zabriskie. Oh yeah. If you listen the new Super American album sometime, like he did a bunch of work with Every Time I Die. Like, he's fantastic. And that studio is great. But you know, it's kind of an interesting thing where our local music scene here in Buffalo is so vibrant. I could go to shows almost every single night of the week, and it's a small city, and I feel like it's the exact same way, where I'm just like kind of barely discovering what's going on. Does that make sense?
I would guess that you guys also, because the density, like population density, is so much bigger. So one thing that we suffer with is that we're 6 hours from Regina. We're 8 hours from Minneapolis.
Yeah.
And then going east, oh my God, like, what's next? Well, there's Thunder Bay. That's 8 hours, but that's not a destination city for shows.
Yeah.
So we do get some tours, but you guys, because of the population density, you not only have all the local stuff, but you also, I would imagine you have 4 to 5 times more acts coming through. And if it's not in Buffalo, like, you can just drive for it.
Oh yeah, and we get Toronto.
Right? Like, it's
right up the lake.
It's right there.
It's right there.
So it's a little bit different that way. I remember our like Undecided's first tour, I think was 96. We literally booked it all ourselves, like cold call telephone, and drove, you know, to Vancouver and then down to San Francisco and across the States. And, you know, half the shows got canceled, and we were playing, we slept on the stage at Gilman Street, like in San Francisco. I just remember, showing up there and looking at the flyer. Because they had these flyers of what was all playing that night. And there was like 45, 50 shows. And a number of those shows were like some of our favorite bands in the scene. And we're like, why would anybody come to our show? And it was eye-opening to realize how much density is there. Like, I think Lagwagon was playing. Like, I think Limp Bizkit was playing in some arena or something. Like, it was just like, you know, they weren't a favorite band, but I'm just thinking like, wow, they're taking all the people. And we had like, you know, there was like 20 people, regular bar goers at Gilman Street, and, you know, you do your best or whatever, but you're like, wow, the density.
Yeah. Tell me about some of your favorite people and artists that you to work with in Winnipeg. Like, I know that, you know, leaving people out is like a danger and everything like that, but I'm just curious about some of your favorite friends and experiences and records that you've made over the last, you know, several years.
You know, maybe I'll just, can I jump back to just the last thing we were talking about with the variety?
Totally.
So one of the things that is kind of like, I think about it all the time. It's like, I'm kind of a jack of trades.
Yeah.
Like, so positives, like, so, you know, I just recorded a record for Leaf Rapids, and I love them, and I love what they did on this record. Very different than Chastity, very different than Propaganda, right? And
yeah,
the positive thing for me is like, I'm really diverse in my musical interests. Like, I'm perfectly happy, like, exploring some like neoclassical or like some Icelandic, kind of like trancy music or whatever. Like, I love watching like Circle episodes on YouTube, you know, concerts in various places. And it's, you know, I'll watch DJ sets. So I'm diverse in my listening, and I'm really glad to work with real diversity, because there's a new puzzle to unlock with everything that you do. So, okay. So that's a positive side. Negative side is to really get big in a genre and really hone your skills, it's almost like you almost have to factory it to especially with metal, because there's very specific tonal casts and ways of resampling drums and like bass tones and things like that, that, you know, it benefits doing many, many, many records and getting the experience super high in one place.
Yeah.
So I'm constantly thinking about like, would I be even better if I did just one genre?
Yeah.
Or whatever. And part of the reason for the multi-genres is being a studio owner. So Private Ear is owned by myself and my wife, Vanessa, and she's the project manager. We have another suite. We've got about 5 engineers that do, you know, we work on film projects. We've worked on like a bunch of Hallmarks. We just did some dubs on for Lucasfilm, and I can't say. Anyways, Yeah, I can't say stuff.
That's fine. Totally fine.
But
don't.
It's super cool that we get to do all these things, and being a commercial space, we do filter projects a lot. Like, and I don't take on every project, but we do take projects that want us to work on them, even if they're in different genres. Like we've done classical, we've done like jazz. Mm-hmm. And so you don't just say like, no, I don't work on that genre. I'm just going to do this one thing.
Yeah.
Because we also have to pay rent at the building. Like our other side is that we do a ton of hip hop.
Nice.
And yeah. And stuff like that. Our other engineer, Derek, is like, he's absolute tops in that realm. And we've built an Atmos room. So we can now do like Atmos mixes for projects. And a lot of labels are starting to ask for that stuff. So the diversity is good. If I was just freelancing, my thought would be I would be more limited in genre. But yeah, it's just an interesting thing to look at.
Yeah, you know, and whenever you talk about that specialization, I think about someone like Ryan Green, who was so notorious for recording Fat Records stuff in the late 1990s. And if you go back and listen to...
Yeah, that was West Side, I think, right?
Yeah,
not West Side, East West.
There was a West Beach...
West Beach.
But there was also, I think Ryan Green was mostly working at Motor Studios in San Francisco with Fat Mike from NoFX. But you think about those late 90s Fat Records, and like Ryan got so well known for that. But like, you know, then I'm listening to this Royal Canoe, which is like some funky hip hop that kind of reminds me of like a mixture of like Blackalicious and Jamiroquai. And I'm like, my God, this is so fun. The variety of stuff that you get to do that, like, I personally think that your approach would be just so much more rewarding and fulfilling just as a fan of music in general, to see what people can come up with.
Maybe that's why I'm not super bored.
Yeah. Totally. Man. Okay. So now what I'm seeing is like, now what I want to know is like, how much you work with bands. Like, do you collaborate and play on a lot of records? Do people have you help like produce and like rearrange song arrangements? Like, does that, like, do you do kind of everything in that regard as well?
I'm working on a pop project right now, with an artist named Kalea, and she's like a brand new artist that has a lot of musical vision. And I'm basically building everything with her.
Mm.
She doesn't play any instruments, sings, and comes in with, but she's like a kernel visionary. And what I mean there is like, that's actually what I lack, is I can't say, this is what I'm going to write a song about. It's just not my thing. If you give me a context or a melody, I can build instrumentation and see a vision. I can see five visions for where things could go, but like deciding what to do. And that was one really hard thing when I was in the undecided. I was relied on for like the most of the writing. Well, actually, no, it was myself and Steve. So our writing would come out of riffs and jam, right? But I don't like having to make that decision. So if I get a brief or like, hey, we need a song about this with this kind of vibe, then I can go. But it's coming up with that brief myself. That's the thing that's odd. So with Kalea, for example, she'll bring in half a verse and a melody, and I build the whole song.
Mm.
Like everything, programming beats, like playing organic instruments, playing MIDI instruments, and I just freaking love it. And
dude,
and like, and it's hot, and I just, it's so fun doing that. And then there's other artists like Leaf Rapids, where they've crafted their album. And Propaganda too, like in this case, I mean, I haven't even heard the demos yet.
Yeah.
It's
very excited about that project, by the way.
Yeah. I mean, I like to hear stuff in advance. Like with Cancer Bats, it's like, we did pre-production in advance. I hear everything, even though they're mostly, they've got their direction. But what I want to know is there any holes that need to be filled? Right. Is there anything that, and then it depends what their relationship is with me insofar as like, do they want, how much perspective do they want as a producer? Like, am I just helping them achieve the best version of that? Or are they asking me for decisions? And I'd say it's about 50-50,
yeah,
like in projects. So the Kalea project would be like, it's totally co-written, right? And then Propaganda, like, I'm not a writer. I'm helping them achieve their sound, make them comfortable, like just fill in production holes, be open-minded and ready to try other things, to bring like other ideas to the table and bounce things around and be a mirror, right? Mm-hmm. So, and I like that. I really, really enjoy that. But I also, it's a different hat.
Yeah.
I suppose.
Okay.
And with Cancer Bats too, Cancer Bats is very like, capture them.
Yeah.
Like Liam singing in the booth right over there, the band's playing live. We're going to keep a whole bunch of it, you know, and I'm like, you know, Liam is remembering, oh yeah, take two, the verse. That was my best verse. And we go through and comp his favorite choices, because I have to focus on the drums.
Yeah.
Because drums always come first. As far as like, you go, for a rock band, you got to have the rhythm section down. So I'm focusing on Mikey and we're locking that in, but he's remembering the other stuff. And man, we comped both of those two records. We comped like 95% off his scratch takes with the band.
Dude.
Which is awesome.
That is so cool to hear about, because I never would have considered about using scratch vocals on a finished product. Like, wow. Awesome.
Well, and
love it.
And we're not using them as scratch, right? Like he's miking them. We're miking them properly.
Yeah.
Actually, we were using this mic or one of these.
Nice.
Yeah. The SM7B. But like, so for him, you know, when we did the Spark That Moves, I'm like, guys, Liam can't be singing every take. This doesn't work. He's going to blow his voice out. I mean, you know what he sounds like. Huge, aggressive, you know, guttural, dynamic. Like, he can't do that. And they're like, no. He'll be better at 3 p.m. Like, he will never lose his voice. He just goes. But he knows which ones he really cared about. And then we pick those takes. But that's mind-blowing to me. Most people would have blown their voice after 2 hours. He can sing for 6, 7. It's insane.
Yeah. Yeah, and then those
and
are not
it's
light
experience.
Records.
No, not at all. Now, he's probably going conservation mode if he's not in the mood. Like, and what I mean by that is he's just singing a little lighter. He's not stressing his voice out. He's just like whatever. But when he digs in, it's like he goes all or nothing. And I appreciate that so much with any player. Like, whether it's, yeah, it doesn't matter what your instrument is. It's full commit. That's how I feel when I'm recording. I want to like full commit anything I do. So, but as a producer, 50% of the time I'm trying to get people to commit.
Yeah.
And get out of their heads. Right. So seeing someone like Liam just like knock it out of the park, and I don't even have to do anything. It's a pleasure.
Amazing. Okay. So, you know, you just mentioned something about get out of your heads, and there's something totally not music related, but maybe it is music related that I wanted to ask you about, because I am a road cyclist. I ride my bike all the time, and it is hands down one of the most essential things that I do for my own mental and physical wellness. And I know that you ride bikes a lot too, and I was curious if you have any thoughts on what that hobby does for you and maybe how that helps you in your own profession as well. Cause you're like, I'm at a desk job all day and it's one of the most essential things that I could ever do for myself. So how does that tie in for your lifestyle as well? Riding bikes and stuff like that.
Well, absolutely the same, like the same as you. So I actually made a determined, I think it was around 2007, like when Private Ear was starting, I'm like, okay, I have to make like decisions on lifestyle that I'm going to commit to, because sitting here and doing music, like it's great, but you're sitting here. So I did love biking before, but I kind of made it a point to like take it up as a fitness, you know, so whatever it is, you have to balance the sitting. That said, I love being out on a bike. I like, you know, I've done 15 years of mountain bike racing. I've like traveled for it. You know, I've done like 24-hour mountain bike races overnight and, you know, short XC stuff. And I haven't done a ton of road racing. Do you road race?
I don't race. I don't race at all.
Okay.
I raced when
okay.
I was in college, and I have left that behind because I've realized that is not part of the equation for me in making my life better. I don't bring the racing into it. I would rather do 60 miles by myself and not say a word for 3.5 hours than be in a race and be in a highly pressurized situation where I'm always worried that I'm going to crash, because I'm not super graceful on a bike, but so that's not part of it for me, the racing.
I think what racing does for me is I get very precious about music, and I can really, really beat myself up if I'm not happy with how things are going. Like if I, and mixing is, mixing's a roller coaster for me sometimes. Like if I'm having trouble with a certain thing, for example, I was just mixing a super heavy song with, and I could not get the bass tone that I was imagining. And what racing does for me is it's a steam reliever. Like I get butterflies in my stomach. I hate being at the start line. And I hate the pain of being in the event and going as hard as you can. But man, you feel so good after. And I feel like it gives me a blow off steam balance to like the pressure that I put on myself in caring about music so much. And it doesn't mean I don't care, but I think it gives me an alternative to be stressed about as opposed to bottling it.
Yeah.
Maybe. So that, yeah, for me, I thought that's where you're going to go when you were talking about the get out of your head thing.
Yeah,
that's a whole, like racing specifically, there's a whole head game. Like I'm saying stuff like, oh, you're just slowing down. Oh, you can't maintain this pace. Oh, that person's going to like catch up to you or like whatever. It's just, it's so ridiculous. And dealing with the head game, it's so huge.
Yeah.
With everything.
And for me, it's a mental health thing as well. Like I am prone to minor bouts of depression here and there. And so I have found that those things, I was thinking about this recently because in college, when I was writing all the time, I was always happy and content in my life. And then when I was moving around, like between bouncing from jobs to jobs, being a new parent, things like that, and I wasn't writing, I found that I was way less happy, which I didn't make the connection. But then I rediscovered cycling in the last like couple of years. And like, I realized that the more I ride my bike, the less likely I am to be hit with those little minor bouts of depression. So for me, it's like just a massive boost in my outlook in the world and just like being a positive person, being hopeful, as opposed to being not hopeful and, you know, being prone to bouts of doom. The connection for me is being on my bike in so many ways.
How would you describe that feeling of like you go for the early morning workout or ride or whatever it is? The rest of the day is different. Like it's not
replaceable. Like, so yesterday I woke up at 6 o'clock in the morning, just my cats walked on me and boom, I was awake. And I looked at, checked
we the must
temperature,
live in the same house.
The winds. Oh God. And so checked the wind and I was like, whoa, there's only a 3-mile-an-hour wind, which in Buffalo, it's like amazing because it's always windy here. So I was like, okay, I'm going to ride now. And I just knocked out 12 miles and then I came back to my desk and I was like, you know, grading my essays and stuff like that. And I was happy as can be. So if you go from being in bed to being on your bike and then coming and starting my day, it's an irreplaceable difference between, you know, just crawling out of bed and then limping to my desk and then just like sitting down and, you know, going from laying in bed to sitting at my desk, totally different experience.
When 2022, when I did the Comeback Kid record, one thing I have a good friend who's kind of like a coach. And he said like, your problem is you always like when life gets busy, you just stop writing. And you'll get better benefit out of with the consistency. So we actually like, so the Comeback Kid record was 30, I don't know, I think it was like 38 days or something. We did like 6 days a week with one day off, which was a requirement for me because the problem, you know, as engineer, and we did have like Derek also engineering and editing drums and stuff like that, but like the band takes turns, but you're on like,
yep,
on game for 10 hours straight. And yeah. So that's the other thing is I don't want to work. I'll do 14 hours if it's in a pinch for a project, but if it's like a, you know, a multi-week project or something like that, you have to be able to eat healthy, get sleep, like, and refresh. And part of that was like, so my friend Trevor was helped to schedule workouts in. He's like, you're going to do shortened workouts, but you're going to do them on these days and I'm your accountability. And I'm like, great. So yeah. I did that and I pulled through that entire recording process while still getting the rides in.
Yeah.
And overall, it was like such a positive experience. It's easy to forget that and to just get lazy and not do it.
Mm-hmm.
But, and actually Andrew was going through a major period of like, you know, eating better and, yeah, eating better, working out, et cetera. And like, his like strength and presence in the project was just insane. Like how he was able to do so many days of back-to-back vocals. And he was so much healthier.
Yeah.
According to him.
It makes a huge difference. And the fact that I've already got like more than 2,000 miles in since the beginning of April, is huge for me. The other day I rode, last week I rode more than 200 miles in a week for the first time since 2005. So for the first time in two decades, I rode more than 200 miles. And I know I'm on a Canadian podcast right now, and I am going to get ripped for my use of mileage there.
Just multiply times 1.4, so 450 kilometers.
Yeah, there we go. So it was a good week, right?
475.
Real good week for me. And I'm so glad that you know about cycling too, because it is just a magical thing that nothing else does for me like that. Like I've tried running, hate it, did it for years, can't stand it. I used to be a swimmer. That black line on the bottom of the swimming pool is like, it haunts my dreams. Cycling, you go places, man. You go places, and it's such a variety of experiences as you change directions on a route, and the wind hits you in different ways, and cars are messing with you in certain ways. And it's just like, there's nothing like it for me. So I'm glad that you understand that experience too.
Are you a group ride kind of person?
Nope.
Like, mostly solo, hey?
All solo. The only person I ride with is my dad, or my, when he comes to Buffalo to visit, or my friend Dave, who also lives in St. Louis, that I grew up with and actually got me into cycling in 2001. So there's two people that I ride with. I don't do group rides. I like being able to make my own decisions as far as red lights and stop signs go. And so I find that I just have a way more pleasurable experience in an isolated way. So it's just kind of the way I roll, you know?
Awesome.
All right. Well, JP, what a pleasure to connect with you and chat about the studio, music, life, engineering versus performing, being in bands. I feel like we've covered a lot of ground here today, and I am super delighted that we could come on and chat about the work that you're doing in Winnipeg for Witch Police Radio. What a pleasure. Do you want to like promote any links or anything like that for the listeners out there?
I don't think so. I mean, if you want to see my work, johnpaulpeters.com, there's some links to some playlists and other stuff that we do, but yeah, no.
John Paul Peters, Private Ear in Winnipeg. Thank you so
Private
much
Ear
for
Recording.
Being here. Private Ear Recording. Great place.
The studio's website is privateearrecording.com.
You've made some of my favorite records of all time, so being able to hang out with you is beyond awesome for me. So thank you so much for being here.
You are too kind. It's a pleasure.